Our speaker today, Mrs. Betty Checkley, whom we give a very warm welcome to, was formerly with the Children's Court, a very sad job in many ways. I would like to read to you now a poem that I first heard read by a senior youth officer with the Department of Youth and Community Services. He was speaking to a group of people involved in work with the Boys and Girls Rally. It's an organisation very similar to the Boys and Girls Brigades that many of you would know. He was encouraging us to continue in the work of leading the young in the right direction, of training up a child in the way he should go. See if you can draw any parallels. It's not a scriptural type of poem, but it has some meaning here for us just the same, I'm sure. It's called The Parable of the Dangerous Cliff. It was a dangerous cliff, as they freely confessed, though to walk near its crest was so pleasant, but over its terrible edge there had slipped a duke and full many a peasant. The people said something would have to be done, but their projects did not at all tally. Some said, put a fence round the edge of the cliff, others an ambulance down in the valley. The lament of the crowd was profound and was loud, as their hearts overflowed with their pity. The cry for the ambulance carried the day as it spread through the neighbouring city. A collection was made to accumulate aid, and dwellers in highway and alley gave dollars or cents, not to furnish a fence, but an ambulance down in the valley. But the cliff is all right if you're careful, they said, and if folks ever slip and are dropping, it's not the slipping that hurts them so much as the shock down below when they're stopping. So for years we have heard as these mishaps occurred, quick forth would the rescuer sally to pick up the victims who fell from the cliff with an ambulance down in the valley. Said one to his police, a marvel to me, that you give so much greater attention to repairing results than to curing the cause. You had much better aim at prevention, for the mischief, of course, should be stopped at its source. Come, neighbours and friends, let us rally. It's a far better sense to rely on a fence than an ambulance down in the valley. He is wrong in the head, the majority said. He would end all our earnest endeavour. He's a man who would shirk this responsible work, but we will support it forever. Aren't we picking up all, just as fast as they fall, and giving them care liberally? A superfluous fence is of no consequence if the ambulance works in the valley. The story looks queer, as we've written it here, but things oft occur that are stranger. More human, we assert, and to succour the hurt is the plan of removing the danger. The best possible course is to safeguard the source, attend to things rationally, is build up the fence, and let us dispense with the ambulance down in the valley. Now, I wonder if you could see any parallels there. I was challenged when I heard that poem, first of all. What a responsibility we have to build a fence of love and protection around the children that God has given us. And not only our own children, but those of our friends and our neighbours and others that we come in contact with from time to time. God loves them all, and he expects us to do our part in helping to protect those children. Some of us think that because we're active in Christian work, that our children will automatically be all right. Others feel that they have no need of God in their lives, and they can handle their children and bring them up in their way. But I think both those attitudes are wrong. We do need God, and if we cover the children with prayer and build up a fence around them of love, perhaps the ambulance that's down in the valley will not be needed quite so often, and the children's court certainly wouldn't be quite as busy as they are. I think that's something that's worth thinking about for each one of us today, whether it's children we have or grandchildren or some others, that we can build up a fence around them with our love and with our prayers. Mrs. Checkley will come and bring us a message for today.
You know, as I stand before you today, I feel something like Lord Rochester, who's reported to have said that before he was married, he had six theories about children and no children. And now that he was married, he had six children and no theories. And I feel just a little bit like that, because most of you will know that as Betty Vaughan, I worked in the Department of Child Welfare, or Department of Youth and Community Services, as it's now known, for just over 30 years, and had many theories about children. But for the last 2.5 years, I've had 4 stepchildren who've been trying to rear me and having quite a difficult time of it, and somehow they've shattered some of my theories, but they've very much reinforced some of the other more basic ones that I had. For just as Lorna has sung to us, he never changes, he never changes. So the very basics of human love and human relationships do not change. And the principles that are outlined in God's book, the Bible, do not change. And if I was taught one thing in those 30 years that I worked in that department, it was that what God has written in his word is true and applicable, no matter what your circumstances. And they do give you something worth living for. Over those 30 years, I spent a great deal of my time, as some of you know, in and out of the children's courts, because my particular role for most of my career was to work with delinquent girls and promiscuous women, and to try to help them and prevent them becoming more delinquent, more promiscuous, or becoming delinquent or promiscuous in the first place. And I feel that just as Christ never changes, so the message and the force of the powerful message that God can give us through a visit to the children's court does not change either. So today I thought I'd go back in my imagination and ask you to come with me back to the children's court and have an imaginary look at what's going on there, perhaps today, but certainly what was going on there in many of the days when I visited. And as we sit quietly in our imagination in the back of that courtroom, I'd like you to remember 2 things. The first, that God can speak to us through all we see and hear in every area of our life. And I'm confident he can speak to us through what we'll see and hear as we in imagination visit the children's court. And secondly, that what you will be seeing and what you will be hearing is something that you would not normally be privileged to see or hear. Because the children's court is a closed court, and members of the press, members of the public, are not normally allowed to enter into it. So we'll sit just quietly there and have a look around before we listen into the first case. You're rather disappointed, perhaps, as you go into the court, because your imagination tells you that the courtroom is something like the TV dramas that you see, or something like the courtrooms that you've seen in pictures. But this is a very ordinary room with very ordinary furniture in it. Across one end of the room is a very old table. It's been there for a long while. Because the court that I thought we would visit would be the Albion Street Court, and as most of you know, it was built somewhere around about Governor Phillips' day, and not too much has been done to its architecture or plumbing since that time, and it shows the evidence of that. At that table at the top of the room sits the magistrate. He just wears an ordinary business suit, and there's nothing that particularly distinguishes him. Adjoining the far end of his table are 3 other tables, buttered one up against the other. At the first one sits the deposition clerk, who takes down everything that is said in the courtroom on his typewriter. Next to him sits the court officer, who corresponds to the prosecutor in an adult court. And that particular person is always somebody trained in law, but always somebody who is an officer of the Department of Youth and Community Services. Next to that officer sits the ordinary clerk of the court, who keeps the record of names and addresses. And then we have joined on to table across here, 3 tables butted down here, and then to complete as it were a letter U, at the bottom we have another 2 tables. At the first table sit the court youth workers and church workers who are permitted into the court in order that they might offer help and guidance to those who come before it. And next to the church court workers sit 2 gentlemen. You're not quite sure who they are, but as they stand up and walk, they have something about their build and size and gait that tells you they're certainly policemen, even though they don't wear a police uniform. You know how you grow something like a uniform that you wear all the time? Well, they do too. And they're the court constables. I'd like you to remember that that furniture is shaped like the letter U. And right in the middle of the letter U are 3 chairs. On one chair sits the young person brought before the court, and the 2 chairs adjacent to that are reserved for his parents or her parents. When I started in the department, some 33 years ago now, it was usual that both chairs were filled. When a child came before the court, usually mum and dad or Mum and Grandfather, if Dad was deceased, would be there. By the time I left 2 and a bit years ago, it was very seldom that both chairs were filled, and very frequent that both chairs were empty. I'd like you to just think about what that tells us about changes in our society over 3 decades, and changes in the attitudes between parents and children, and changes in community response to parental responsibility. Now, I don't know you people, so I'm just not familiar with what your court records are. Some of you may have been before the court many times, and some of you may never have been before the court. But I'm sure that all of you have some idea of what a court is like. So I'd like to tell you how a children's court differs from an adult court. You'll all know from your personal knowledge of courts, whether that be by observation or by being there personally, that in an adult court, the punishment is said to fit the crime. But in a children's court, the order made is said to fit the child before the court, not necessarily the offence or complaint for which the child comes before the court. In an adult court, you'll recall that frequently counsel jumps up and down objecting to this or that and saying that it should not be admitted as evidence because the law of evidence is very strictly adhered to. In the children's court, the law of evidence has to be adhered to too. But before the order is made, the magistrate is obliged to read all other reports tendered to him, which might give him some guidance or some additional information that would be helpful in making the most appropriate order for the child with whom he is working. The major difference between the court in which an adult appears and the court in which a child appears is that an adult court is essentially a court of punishment, and a children's court is a court of prevention. And doesn't that fit in with the poem that was read to us a little earlier about the fence at the top of the cliff or the ambulance in the valley? Now let's listen to a few cases as they come before the court. You're disappointed when the first person appears because it's an adult and you had your mind quite set on looking at children. It's a father brought before the court under the Public Instruction Act because it is alleged that without lawful excuse, he failed to send his children to school on each half day the school was open. He proclaims very loudly that it's his wife's responsibility to see the children get off to school, and he can hardly be blamed for that. But the magistrate explains to him that God in his wisdom gave him the privilege of being head of the house, and if he wants to be head of the house, then he must accept the responsibility, and that the law places the responsibility fairly and squarely on him. And so he's fined for each half day that the child has been away from school. I don't know, you know, whether you realise that it is an offence to keep your child away from school for a morning or an afternoon, or for both, without reasonable excuse, and that those notes that you write to the school become legal documents. You might just think about that when you use that scrap of paper next time to write the notes to the teacher on, that they can be subpoenaed in the court. And you know, they're very remarkable things. There is nothing more interesting for a wet morning than to look at a teacher's note file. You'd be surprised at just what it looks like and what it reads like and what it tells you about the standard of spelling and writing of parents. A great deal, I can assure you. The next one before the court is a young girl brought before the court as a neglected child in that without lawful excuse she fails to attend school. She's sent to school very regularly, but she fails to stay there when Mum and Dad send her, or fails to arrive there quite often. She truants very frequently. And the magistrate is told just all that has been done to try to help her, a change of school, a change of teacher, a great deal of counselling with the family, a great deal of help and support and encouragement to her, but she has continued to fail to attend school regularly. And as the girl admits this is the true state of affairs of what has happened over the previous 8 or 9 months, she is released on probation and is sent from the court on an order of probation under the supervision of exactly the same officer who brought her before the court. You might wonder why then take the child before the court. It just does add that extra assurance to both that should the girl truant again, she knows that this will not mean that she will escape school, but only that she will not have the opportunity of choosing whether she goes or not, for she would be in an institutional setup where the school was on the premises and she would have to face up to the responsibility. The court is essentially a tool of prevention, a therapeutic tool used by an officer, not to get rid of a case, but to help in a case, and where it can't help or cannot achieve something that cannot be done without going before the court, it should never be used. You strain your necks to see the next one before the court. She's so small. We would say she's about 2 years of age. We'll never quite know just how old she is. A tiny little girl with black eyes, black curly hair, looking very, very attractive, with a very pretty little simple frock on, with an apple-shaped pocket, in which she obviously has a coin and which is fascinating her as the proceedings continue. She's brought before the court because it's alleged that she is a neglected child in that she is destitute. She's lifted onto the chair, and the court constables go outside and solemnly call her name three times outside, and then come in and say, "Unaccompanied, Your Worship," and the case proceeds. The story's told how on the previous Friday afternoon, an officer had gone down to a caravan in a swampy area in response to a call from a woman who lived near the swampland. This woman had said that she was in the habit of taking her dog for a walk along the edge of that creek and the swampland nearby, and on the Thursday when she had done so, she had thought she heard the sound of a child in a caravan that was abandoned down there. She'd gone home and told her husband, and her husband said, "Oh, don't be silly, there are all sorts of noises in a swamp." And she thought, well, that seemed quite logical, because she couldn't make anyone answer her when she went over to the caravan. But it troubled her all night. And so the next morning she'd gone again down to the caravan with her dog, and again she thought she heard a child's whimper inside. She was very distressed about it and tried to get into the caravan and couldn't, and came back and finally decided she'd ring up the department. I clearly remember it being the officer involved, and remember going down to that same caravan, not very many miles away from here, situated just on the side of a creek, and thinking I too could hear a very faint little whimper inside. I was not as law-abiding as the lady and did gain entry into the caravan, and there I saw a little child, this little child that we now see before the court. She was crouched up in one corner of a bunk, trying, as it were, to fade into the very woodwork of that caravan, in absolute fear. She was in a shocking condition. Her clothing was vermin-infested, her legs were very, very, very scalded, and she was fly-blown from having been left unattended for so long. She was a sad little girl, and a frightened little girl, a terrified little girl. For you know, a caravan's a wonderful thing in which to have a holiday, but it's a most uncomfortable and lonely thing in which to be left alone, particularly if you're about the age of two. And we think she was, by the state of development of her teeth, which is the only way that you can tell about how old a child is if you don't know their birthday, is how their teeth are growing. This little girl had been picked up, and I'd carefully taken off her clothes as we played the game of dressing up in the special clothes that I had in the boot of the car, the routine uniform which many officers at the Department of Youth and Community Services, or Department of Child Welfare as we used to know it, carry with them. It's made of Sydney Morning Heralds and pins. What on earth are we going to do if ever the Sydney Morning Herald goes small like the Telegraph? I do not know, because it's just not big enough to go around many sized children. But Sydney Morning Heralds can make great shirt and trousers, and they make huge frocks and pinafores, and you can do all sorts of things which help to establish a relationship with the child and make the child a little less itchy and scratchy and more cuddable, if you know what I mean. It's hard to cuddle a child that's vermin-infested and maggot-ridden, if you know. You do it, but it is hard to do, particularly if you're driving the car. This little girl had been taken to one of the foster homes that we have, which act as remand homes, where she was cared for just over the weekend while efforts were made to trace her identity and to help her. It was in that remand home that the lady of the house had made the little frock which she was now wearing. As the case proceeded and the circumstances were being outlined to the magistrates, the little girl, oblivious to the whole solemnity of the occasion, had slipped off the chair and gone over to the magistrate. He quite instinctively just picked her up and sat her on his knee for the rest of the proceedings, and said, "You know, Betty, it's dreadful when we think of it, that the order I can make today could make or mar the whole of the future of this child's life. Yet she's so completely unaware of all that's going on, and so trusting." He said, "What a responsibility on both of us." And it is too, isn't it, as we think about it. The evidence was unfurled of how over that weekend efforts had been made to identify the child. There was nothing in the caravan that would help. The drawers and cupboards were empty. Nothing at all that would identify. The child had obviously been abandoned for a reason. Inquiries roundabout led to the possibility that the mother of the child was a woman who had a husband in jail serving a long sentence. He'd been interviewed in jail and been very helpful. He'd been in jail for sufficiently long not to be the father of the child. He thought the child was probably the result of a union his wife had with a de facto, and he knew that both his wife and that de facto were involved in the electrical business. He thought this probably had something to do with their disappearance, for it wasn't a conventional electrical business. They used to steal electrical appliances and resell them. And he knew the police were probably hot on their trail about this. Both of them had long records and would be very anxious to escape another committal in a court because of their long record and the possibility that they would be declared habitual criminals. He felt they had probably fled to another state where apprehension was less likely. And of course, if you're on the run, one thing you do not want to do is to take a child with you, for a child will quickly identify you. You think of your last visit to the supermarket. You've probably forgotten every adult that you bumped, into whose trolley you banged, and who tended to take the last packet of reachable Renzo off the shelves. But you will remember some of the children you saw hurriedly trying to eat potato chips before they got to the checkout, who were screaming in the supermarket or busy filling Mum's basket with things she didn't want. Some of those will stay in your memory, but none of the adults will, probably. Because we do remember children. And of course that made me very soft as the years went by towards criminals who were on the run or delinquent young people who kept with them their children, because you knew immediately you had something very positive with which to start working if they thought of the child before they thought of their own freedom. The little girl was eventually made a ward of the state, and I can clearly remember leaving the court that day wondering what to do, how on earth to cope with all the many things that had to be fitted into the day. And I thought the more quickly I get this little girl down to the children's home and can get on with the job, the better. But you know, God stopped me. Something made me realise that the important thing was not to get that little girl down to the children's home, but right there and then to stop and to find her somewhere where she could go that was secure and permanent and lasting, a foster home. That wasn't exactly my job at that stage. We had officers in the department who used to take over from us then. But there was always that delay of perhaps a week or 10 days or so while the best foster home was being found for her. Now, I knew I had a resource that would do the job a lot more quickly than that, and so I used it, and I prayed, Lord, just which one should she go to? But you know, I didn't like God's answer. I don't know if you ever do get answers from God that you're not over happy about and you'd like to resubmit them to him for further consideration. Well, I had one of those experiences because he brought to my mind a couple that I hadn't particularly taken to when I visited them first a year or so before. They were a couple who were honest enough, decent enough, and obviously very good people. But I just somehow didn't take them. He was 20 years older than her, and for some illogical reason I had a prejudice about men being 20 years older than wives. Now, I know that's not logical, it's not a good thing, but I did have that feeling about it that there was something just a bit funny about a marriage where a man was 20 years older. I might have settled for 15, but 20 didn't seem quite right. And so I somehow didn't take to them. I can remember that lady saying, what we'd really like, Miss Vaughan, is a little preschool-age girl. And I said, look, we've got hundreds of people waiting for preschool-age girls, and we don't often get preschool-age girls, which was the truth. I said, but you know, we do have lots of freckle-faced 13-year-old boys, particularly with red hair. And she said, well, I guess that must be the child that needs us. Well, we'll have to settle for that, won't we? And I could remember being rebuked by that. But however, when I wrote the report, I recommended it be an excellent home for a freckle-faced 13-year-old red-headed boy. And we had lots of those, and they were in danger of having a child in their home within days, except that the father of the house got ill and went to hospital. She asked us to defer placement until he was back at work again, which we had done. And so when I rang up to say, I presume you've used the home of Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so by now for a 13-year-old boy, they said, well, as a matter of fact, we haven't, because the husband there was slow to recover, but he is back at work now, and we were thinking of ringing you tomorrow about a boy. So I said, well, I guess you better not. So I just rang and I said to her, it's Miss Vaughan here from Child Welfare, and she said, well, don't tell me what it is. She said, I've just got off my knees and the Lord told me I was going to be a parent today, and so she hung up. So I never did have a chance to discuss the child with her, but I thought, oh, well. So out I set and got the child outfit and out I went to the home. Well, you can imagine, she was all prepared for a freckle-faced 13-year-old red-headed boy. And I arrived with the most delightful, pleasant little 2-year-old girl. And I will never forget her words as she saw that child. She just said abundantly more than I could have asked or expected. And I was rebuked, and I guess a lesson I shall never forget, that God knows far better than we do. For as the years unfolded, that little girl had problems which perhaps only that home could have coped with. And perhaps only the maturity of that man would have been adequate to have met her need. They, of course, did later on take that boy. And they did also take a very difficult 17-year-old girl. And they did do a wonderful job with all three of them. For God knew them as I didn't. And God was able to select in a way I couldn't. His wisdom was so much greater. The next one before the court is a young girl, brought before the court as an uncontrollable young person. Because it's alleged that she ran away from home because she objected to her father. Her parents were migrants and she objected to her father trying to insist on her complying with the rules of his culture. He didn't want her to go out with boys like all the teenagers that she had grown up with did. She had only been 18 months old when she'd come to Australia. She did not know nor understand nor appreciate the culture of her parents. They insisted on her staying at school to get the best possible education. And all she wanted to do, although she was a competent girl, was to be like the other teenagers in Australia. She was essentially Australian. And there was that awful hiatus between her and her parents. They loved each other. They cared for each other. But they failed to understand the reason why each other was behaving in the way they were. And so she had run away from home. She was a good living girl. All she had done when she ran away from home was get herself a job as a sales girl and a flat in which to live. She wasn't doing anything that was breaking the law in actual fact. But of course she was only 14 years of age, which didn't make her old enough to leave school, and she also was living away from her parents, and the law does not allow that. And so she was brought before the court as an uncontrollable child because she declined when she was located to go back to her parents or even to talk with her parents. It was sad to see the two in the courtroom. The girl with such potential, the parents with such high hopes and dreams for their children, and yet unable to somehow just cross that bridge of understanding that would help them to see that she had grown up in a culture so different to theirs, that there needed to be some give and take both ways. That would help her to see that there was some value in the things that were prized so highly by her parents. Even in the courtroom, the girl said, although she loved her mother and father, that unless they were prepared to let her leave school, unless they were prepared to let her do as Australian girls could do, that she was not prepared to go back to their home. She was given a couple of weeks to think the matter over in the shelter, but she still persisted. And so she was finally committed to a convent, where, of course, in no time at all, she came to see that there was value, perhaps, in going back and continuing her education. And she did go to school, which was really the main thing her parents wanted her to do. She went to school, she subsequently went to university, she did very well, she married a bank manager and she had twins, and she just said later on, in years to come, how she just hoped that her children would not be like her and would grow up to honour her in a way that she had failed to honour her parents. But she said, how I hope too, that I'll be sensitive enough to their needs and their feelings, not to provoke them in a way that is unreasonable. Before the court so often comes tragedy, and the next ones before the court is a mother and a father, obviously heartbroken, sitting next to a boy whom they obviously love. He is charged with the murder of his sister. A very simple household situation that had ended in tragedy. They lived a long way from the shops, they didn't have a motor vehicle, and each Saturday morning the mother and father, who are God-fearing people, were in the habit of going down getting the groceries in order that the husband could carry them home because they were too heavy. And they had left the young people to wash up and wipe up, a thing I guess which most of us often do. An argument had ensued between them as to whose turn it was to wash because there were some greasy things for breakfast and whose turn it was to wipe. And they had argued very vehemently about this very simple matter. In the course of the argument, tempers had been frayed. The boy had picked up a shotgun which his father had left nearby and had aimed it at his sister, and she had fallen dead at his feet. The parents had come back to find the brother crying over his sister's body. A very simple thing had happened. Tempers had got out of control. In the courtroom, there were the parents, grieving for the daughter they loved and had lost, and grieving for the son they loved and didn't know quite how to help. And all they could say outside was, "Why? Why?" There was nothing that you could just put your finger on. Nothing at all. And all we could say to them is, "We don't know, and I guess we never will, this side of eternity." For tragedies happen to Christian folk too. One thing we did know was that their love for the boy would not be altered by what had happened, and they longed most to help him in a way that would mean his future was as scarred as little as possible by the fact of what had happened. All we could say was that God's grace would be sufficient for them. They knew that, but it didn't stop the human tears from flowing. There's a young mother. It's a tragic situation. She's a young mother with two illegitimate children. She herself had lost her mother when she was very young. She's brought before the court because it is alleged that she failed to provide adequate food, clothing and shelter for her baby. Her bound on a hot heatwave day on the top of an anthill outside the little shanty where she lived. The child wore nothing and had been badly eaten by the ants, the bull ants on that ant's bed, and had been badly burnt by the hot sun on that day. 2/3 of the child's body had been burnt, and the child was fighting for life in the hospital. It was very hard, as you looked at that slip of a girl, to imagine that she could do anything so brutal. But as she said, "You know, it was so easy when it happened. Not that I didn't love that baby," she said, "but you see, that morning," she said, "was the one morning in the week when down the bush track the postman used to bring the odd letter I got." And she said, "I got a letter from the baby's father in which he said he had married someone else." She said, "I was so sure he would come back and would pick up the threads of life that we had had together." She said, "You know, I'm only 21 now." And she said, "I felt he'd stand by me, and I'd tried to keep this little shack of a home going in order that he would." And she said, "When I read that he just said, 'You weren't worth much or you wouldn't have had two kids to me,' she said, something inside me just snapped. And she said, I looked at the baby and I didn't see the baby anymore. She said, I saw his face. I saw his face on that baby. And she said, in a rage, I ran out and I dropped the baby on that anthill. And I came inside and I cried and I cried." You know, ladies, I guess there are some things that you cannot erase, even though you see many tragic things if you work in a job as I did, like that. I guess I will never erase from my mind the sight of that child. For God, in his wonderful way, led me to visit that girl that day, and I was the one that found the baby. I remember it was a hot, steamy day, and I parked the car. I parked it as close as I could to the shack, but I still had to walk quite a long way down a narrow bush shack and down some rocky crags that the car wouldn't negotiate. And as I walked down, I heard this child crying, and I went over and I just couldn't believe that what I was seeing was human. For there was the child blistered by that hot sun. That little boy is still in the care of the department. One of the tragic situations was that I didn't know quite where to pick the child up, you know. When you see a very badly burnt child, sunburned like that, it's very hard to know. But I can remember picking him up and running onto the shack where the girl lived, for I knew it quite well, and showing it to her and saying, "Why? Why?" Because she'd always been a reasonably decent mother. She lived in primitive surroundings. She had nothing of this world's wealth, but she had always cared for her children reasonably well under very difficult circumstances. And she was shattered as I was, and I can remember the two of us trying to fix the child up in a cardboard box, which was the best we could do, and her rushing with me to the hospital, and I stopped the car near the first phone box and rang the police for a police escort to get the baby to the hospital before it died. We got the child to the hospital. She was with me all the time, the mother. But unfortunately, we don't quite know whether it was because of the child's experience that day or not, but that child has never seen since. The retina of the eyes was damaged beyond repair. And the child being blind, when I did bring the child before the court, because for her the trauma of trying to look after the child would have been too great, and she did have an older child to consider, and I felt it was more important to help her with the older child, and in the circumstances, because of the very big psychological hang-up she had about this child, to have that placed in protective custody. And when eventually we were able to hold a bedside court, long before the day in which you see her in court, because the child was in hospital for 9 months, when we were able to hold the bedside court, the magistrate made the child a ward of the state, but he also directed that the woman be charged. I didn't want to charge her because I could understand what had happened. Couldn't condone it, but I could understand it. But he directed that she must be charged in the interest of public outrage about it. And charged she was. And it was a difficult situation to be in, to be giving the evidence against a woman you didn't want to see convicted. Because under the law, if a woman is convicted or a man is convicted under that section of the law, there is only 12 months imprisonment or, as it was in those days, a £100 fine. I knew she wouldn't have the fine. I knew that there was guilt, and I didn't want to see her go to prison. The magistrate somehow knew my feelings about it and my ambivalence in trying to do what my job required, that I give the evidence honestly, and yet all the social worker and Christian in me crying out to help that woman and prevent her going to jail. So I was like a split personality in that witness box all that day. But he eventually brought in a finding of guilt, but under the First Offenders Act, admonished and discharged her, and then said to me quietly outside, "Well, you did get it both ways after all. Sorry, I was wrong that she should be charged." And yet you can understand it, can't you, as you look at the situation. You know, all day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks per year, year after year, in that children's court in which you've sat in imagination today, and in two other major children's courts in the metropolitan area, and in many country courts, there's a procession of tragedy and heartbreak and of neglect such as you have seen today. If you do some mental arithmetic, it adds up to a pretty frightening total of the number of children and young people and families that are in distress. How would you feel if you were the parent sitting beside your child in that court? How would you feel if you were a child in that courtroom? We did say at the beginning that the courtroom has U-shaped furniture. It certainly may be true that it has never happened to you or to your child. And by the grace of God, it may never happen to you or your child in the future. But let me remind you that there is one court before which we shall all stand, and one court from which we cannot escape, even if we have escaped that children's court. For the Bible tells us we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ, when every one of us shall give an account of ourselves to God, when God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. We're told that on that day there will be nothing covered that shall not be uncovered, nothing hidden that shall not be revealed. In that day when God shall judge the secrets of men and women by Jesus Christ according to the gospel. God in the Bible, ladies, clearly shows us that one day we shall be in a very special children's court, as it were, a very special type of court, where it will not be our future for this life being determined, but our future for eternity. If we can make a reverent comparison, we can say that God, like the children's court magistrate, is interested in prevention rather than punishment. For we're told in the Bible that he is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Imagine for a moment that you were sitting in that children's court. Surely the most comforting thing for you would be to know that you had an advocate, that you had the best possible lawyer as your advocate, there to plead the good points for yourself and your child. When you stand on that final judgment day, when God shall judge the secrets of men and women by Jesus Christ according to his gospel, will you have an advocate? We're told in the Bible only one advocate will be permitted on that day, the advocate Jesus Christ, the only mediator between God and man and woman. If you'd asked me that question for the first 10 years that I worked in this department, I would have had to answer no, that I didn't even know that advocate. But certainly, after 10 years' experience as a social worker, I met him face to face, and from that day on I've been able to say, on that final judgment day, when all my secrets will be revealed and all the hidden things I don't want known will be told. On that final judgment day, I know that right beside me will be standing Jesus Christ, my Saviour and Lord. And while I know it will be true to say that Betty Checkley did all those things she shouldn't have done and failed to do all those things which she should have done, I know that what the answer will be, I've already paid the penalty for her when I died at Calvary, and so I know what the decision will be for my eternity. Go spend eternity with me. I know that's what God will say. But what about each one of you? What about your children? What about the children in your street, in your suburb? What about the children that come to your church or chapel? As a social worker, I found I needed Jesus Christ to guide me day by day. But how much more do you, in your more important job, as parents of first-hand children? For some reason I don't understand, God has never given me natural children. I've had many other people's children to care for and look after and plan for, and I have stepchildren. But I have never borne a child myself. And you know, it's something like having second-hand material instead of new material. When you're practicing as a dressmaker, you use the second-hand material to learn. But you use the new material when you can be trusted to be really expert in your dressmaking. I found in my lesser job with second-hand material, I needed Jesus Christ as my Lord and Saviour. And I'm confident in your more important job as mothers and grandmothers of first-hand material, newborn children, children of your very own, that you need him too. If you are a professing Christian and you do know Jesus Christ as your Saviour, then remember that on that final judgment day, every one of us will give an account of ourselves to God, of our stewardship. Lorna sang, "Something Worth Living For." If you want something worth living for as a Christian, live for Jesus Christ every moment of the day, in every experience of the day, in every situation and location of your day. Live for him. Think about it. What sort of an account will you give on that final judgment day about the way you've used the talents entrusted to you, about the opportunities that you've been given day by day to speak for Jesus Christ and to work for him, about the way you use your time, 60 seconds of it every minute. You can do a great deal in 60 seconds. You try it and see. About the way you use your home, about the way you use that wonderful privilege of prayer, about the way you use the small things God has lent you, your ability to smile. How stingy are you with your smiles? About the way you use your tongue, the opportunity to speak that word of help, of encouragement, of support, to speak that word that's so desperately needed by that lonely, friendless person. What about your life here in this district? What sort of stewardship have you given of it? What sort of an account will you give on that final day? For as Christians, ladies, we have the responsibility not only to the children in our own immediate care, but to those young people in our community who will day by day continue to fill the lists of the children's courts, unless they receive that personal interest, that love, that understanding, that personal concern that will enable them to see Jesus Christ live before them and will enable them to come face to face with him and be introduced to him so that they might come to know him and not walk life alone. Think about it. As we turn our eyes now to the Word of God, as it's written in the 6th chapter of Luke, beginning at the 31st verse, where we read words that I feel are very relevant to us in this day and age. It says, "And as you would that men would do to you, do so to them. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the selfish. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. Judge not, and you will not be judged. Condemn not, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure,
pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. Give first of yourself to the Lord Jesus Christ, that he might have all of you. Then of your time, your talents, your treasure, all of your opportunities, that he might take them and use them as he will, to his honour and glory. Give, and it will be given unto you, possibly not in this life, but certainly after that final judgment day in eternity.